You are listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice. Hi, welcome to this live discussion by INCJ, which we're recording as a YouTube and podcast for people who maybe want to catch up later. Hello, my name is John Scott, and I'm hosting this event for the International Network Criminal Justice. If you want to find us, you look on www.criminaljusticenetwork.net, or if you want to follow us, it's on Twitter at INTCJNetwork. Today's subject is the hot topic of artificial intelligence and the criminal justice system. It's the first of seven events in our 2022 program. And we've got a panel of experts and a live audience, and we'll be discussing what changes artificial intelligence is bringing and how AI is already impacting criminal justice practice. In a roundtable conversation, contributions will be made by five experts before our live audience, but we'll be inviting you to send in points and questions. And if we can get the system to work okay, I'll invite you to join in the roundtable later in the event to broaden the sense of community. And what we're aiming to do is get the feel of a phone-in radio discussion. But let's just see how it goes. So first, let me introduce our roundtable panel members. It comprises Dr. Victoria Knight from De Montfort University in the United Kingdom. She's an associate professor and has two core areas of research: digital technologies and their use in prisons, and looking at emotion and criminal justice. Next person to welcome is Professor Mike Nellis from the University of Strathclyde in Scotland. And he's written really widely on electronic monitoring and has been a Council of Europe expert advisor on this topic. Next, Pia Puolaka, who's from the Smart Prison Project in Finland. And she has a background as a prison psychologist and is currently the project manager for RISE AI project for the Criminal Sanctions Agency. And then Matt Rowland, who is a technology innovation consultant for criminal justice in the United States. And he's a former chief senior executive officer in Washington, D.C. for the probation and pretrial services. And the final member of the panel is Stephen van der Steen from Smart Corrections Belgium, and he's an expert in digital transformation projects and is a board member of the International Corrections and Prisons Association. Now, we've got lots of space, but that doesn't mean to say that we want huge, long contributions. The aim is that we get snappy, quick points rather than great, long things, paragraphs. And my aim, everybody, is to start things going by asking questions. But if you want to butt in, please raise your hand and we'll make sure that everybody gets a fair say. So I thought I'd get the ball rolling by asking each of you what your take is on AI or artificial intelligence. And perhaps start by asking what is meant by AI and how is it currently being used in the criminal justice system. So what is meant by AI and how is it currently being used? Should we go in alphabetical order to start? And in your second name. So let's start with Victoria, shall we? You need to unmute, Vic.
I was hoping to be last, John.
We could have your first name, couldn't we? So what do we mean by AI?
Well, it's machine learning and where we have machines and technology to work on behalf of humans, to take data, process it according to a set of algorithms, and help humans to make decisions. Very much informed by the work that Mike, who's here today, and I've had lots of lengthy conversations with him about that, you know, when we think about artificial intelligence, particularly in the penal context, and I think this is what's going to be distinctive about this conversation, and I want to labour that point, is that when you, I suppose, place certain technologies within the penal context, it has very distinctive impacts. I think as a researcher on digital technologies within this landscape, I worry about the kind of ethical and moral implications of this. And I'll probably say more about that later. But I think, you know, as a basic definition, and I am no expert on artificial intelligence, I haven't done any research. That's my caveat here. So I feel a bit of a fraud in this conversation, I must admit. But I am being encouraged by peers and practitioners to think more about that. So I think I would like to kind of throw in some questions for me is, you know, how can we ensure that machine learning, because there is an inevitability of movement towards this, how can we ensure that humans aren't harmed as a result of machine intervention? Thank you.
Okay, so Mike, Nellis is next in the alphabetical order. So what would your definition be? You need to unmute, Mike.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think what Victoria said is fair enough as a starting point. The artificial intelligence, and perhaps it's best to put that in speech marks, that we have at the moment is, in effect, machine learning. The creation of vast databases that can be read by algorithms and can, in some senses, teach themselves how to achieve goals in ways that they were not initially directly programmed to do. And they can do this on a vast scale and at a greater speed than people can do them, right?
Yeah.
And in that sense, even the forms of artificial intelligence that we have now are better than human because they can do things at scale and at speed that people can't do. It doesn't mean that they're superior to humans in terms of the, if you like, the actual ideas that they can think or come up with, right? But of course, there are AI experts down the line who say that that will come. And the gist of the Reith lectures that were done on the BBC in England recently was in part exploring that possibility of much more advanced machines than we're operating at the present moment in time. Artificial intelligence as we have it at the moment is not better than human in the sense that it can, you know, whatever it can do at scale and at speed, it can only really do one thing at a time, right? So we call what we've got at the moment narrow artificial intelligence. But general artificial intelligence, which has been worked on and hoped for and anticipated, would be able to do variable tasks, either in sequence or simultaneously. And that, it is said, would approximate much more to what human beings are like, because we can think about several things at once. We can multitask. But at the moment, while artificial intelligence can beat the world's greatest chess players, the world's greatest Go players, and can win quiz shows, it can't do two things at once. And that makes it sound like it's not significant. But of course, narrow AI, in terms of the things that it can do and the managerial implications of that, is a big deal. I mean, it's a very significant thing that we are able to do these vast analyses of databases at scale and at speed. So that's the definition of it. It connects to robotics as well. You can see robotics as a kind of tangent in relation to the broader AI debate. Robots are artificial intelligences that are embodied, sometimes mobile, and capable of doing physical things, right, in a way that by definition isn't intrinsic to AI. But if you talk about robotics, you can do those things as well. So I've only really defined AI in what I've said there. And I think it's coming, right? It is coming. It is going to work. And this is a process that we need to understand professionally, sociologically, politically. It's just I'm personally am not enthusiastic about embracing it.
That's really helpful. And I like that narrow and general, because that's going to help us see it in different stages, isn't it? So thank you very much indeed. Pia, you're working on real projects in Finland. Would you all want to add anything to the definitions that have been given by Victoria and Mike, or does that definition help?
Do you hear me, first of
yes,
all?
Yes, perfectly, yeah.
Okay, yeah. A lot is said already, but I like the definition that AI is something that simulates human intelligence processes. But as Mike said, at the moment, it can only simulate very basic processes, reasoning processes. So it's at its best, it's able to analyze correlations between different items in the data, identifying patterns, and then applying this knowledge to certain questions or to new data. And yes, we have a project that is actually doing this kind of narrow AI type of work, but it's going to be in our new offender management system, and its purpose is to analyze the background data of offenders, and based on these it can recommend some activities during your sentence time, and to and in this way to effect on the risk of recidivism. So that is what it's supposed to do. And you have to also remember that humans make AI. So humans are the ones that program and make the algorithms and tell what are the correlations between different items of data. So you need a lot of experts to make a good and accurate AI system. And in my team, I have a very good psychologist and criminologist with me to work with this new program, so I hope it will be a good system.
Okay, thank you. Matt, in America, would the definitions that so far have come from a European perspective, would those definitions be ones that you would recognize?
I do, and I think it's fairly consistent. I tease Mike periodically, I'm a little more optimistic. I think about the role it could play. Because for me, AI is just yet another tool that could be used to achieve the goals of corrections. And like any tool, it could be misused or it could be used effectively. It could, you know, be in the hands of somebody who is well-meaning, but not, you know, again, technically capable of wielding it correctly. Or on the other hand, it could fall to somebody who is really technically capable, but doesn't have the best of intentions. So I think these conversations that we're having right now are extremely important, because as everyone says, it's an evolutionary process. And we need to work out these concepts and these concerns ahead of time. So we shape AI and AI doesn't shape us, because I definitely agree with all the other speakers that it seems inevitable at this time. It's already around us. It's in our phones. It's in our, you know, communications. It's all over. So it's inevitable. It's going to happen. But again, I think these kind of conversations are critically important to make sure it's serving us and not vice versa.
Okay, thank you. Stephen, I had two parts to my question. One was about definition, and please pick that up. But the other was, how is AI currently being used in the criminal justice system? Let's check out definition with you, but maybe you could move on to think about different ways AI is being used.
Thank you, John. I think about the definition, most of the things have been said already. Mike referred to the different meanings of artificial intelligence, from how powerful it is, if I can say it like that. So you have indeed, we are at the point still of the narrow intelligence, doing one thing at a time. I think it's also very important what Pia mentioned, is that we have to realize that this is still created by humans, and in fact also a little bit anticipating what Matthew says, that it is in fact our very important that AI is supervised by humans, and also how it's built is supervised by humans. So I completely agree. This kind of conversations are very important. What can I say about the use of AI in criminal justice? Together with Pia, we have done a survey on how AI currently is used in prisons last year. And what we see there is, first of all, that it's still very limited its usage. The conclusions of that survey was mainly that people are only start thinking about maybe using it. There are some differences in different countries, of course. We have learned from some countries in Asia where they have taken a little bit more steps already to use AI, like, for example, in Hong Kong or in Singapore. What is very important, I think, is that there are two main areas where AI currently is used in the prison sector anyway. And this is in the context of offender management, a little bit related to what Pia also already referred to, where RISE is working on. And the other one is mainly for security. So it's direct use of AI algorithms to, for example, support the monitoring and then the surveillance of people by using cameras or voice recognition systems and all those kinds of AI-driven technologies to in fact analyze and recognize things that happen from a security point of view. So this is what's happening in the main areas. What I think is more advanced, and also something that it's very important that we look at it to also refer what Victoria is saying from an ethical perspective, is where AI is used to support decision making and what are the boundaries of that. So what I mean with that, in offender management, for example, we see that, and this is not only related to the start of AI, it has been going already for a long time before. For example, using risk assessment systems, where we trust on machines to predict, for example, if an offender will re-offend or not. And this is a very, very difficult environment situation where AI is currently used. And I think it's something that could, I really would like to hear also the other panel members if allow, about how do this they look at this and how, what are their experiences. But this is anyway something of the areas where AI is currently used, and a lot of agencies and private companies are looking into that area of using AI.
Okay, let's pick up your challenge, Stephen, because certainly one of my questions does relate to risk assessment. And I think that will plug into the ethics issues as well that Victoria raised earlier. So you're saying that artificial intelligence is being used, and maybe some algorithm links as well, to looking at the many data fields that might be necessary to assess risk. And in looking at offenders either before release from prison or maybe in writing reports to assess risk, there are big ethical questions coming out of that, I would think. And I'd be particularly interested to take Victoria's earlier challenge about what are the ethical risks that come. Can you use AI to predict behavior, or do people get locked up because an algorithm says they have to stay locked up? So that's an ethical question. And again, it would be great to have your reflections on that. And the other thing that I'd like to say to our audience is, if you've got specific questions coming out about ethics, let's hear those. Okay, so let's move on into maybe the sensitive area of ethics and values. And who would like to pick this up first?
I don't know if this helps, but for me, yeah, for me, the people use the term algorithm, and that's clearly a major component of AI and technology generally. But algorithms predate computers. So the idea of trying to predict behavior and take macro level data to help predict what's going to happen at the micro level, that's been around for a long time. Going to the point that was made, we're now talking about scaling it on a scale that's been unprecedented, taking in what's happened in thousands or maybe even millions of cases to try to predict what's going to happen. But even now, the tools that are currently available, and someone asked, is AI being used to assess risk? Algorithms clearly are. And if not directly AI, AI type tools are being used to predict. And what we're finding, at least in my experience, is at the macro level, it outpredicts, you know, individual people guessing, you know, not guessing or even professional assessments. But it's not as good still at the micro level, at the individual case level. So I think one big distinction that has to be made is, are we talking about AI replacing human decision-making or informing it? And I've heard that phrase used before when folks are going through about what AI is. Again, in my mind, this is that ethical thing that we do have to work out. At what point can, what kind of grunt work can AI do on its own and replace humans? And then what other important decisions can it maybe help inform or study after the fact, but never replace? And I think the in-out decision that you mentioned, I think is one of those decisions AI should not be making. It should be informing and helping give context and studying decisions that are made, but it should not definitively be making the in-out decision.
Victoria would like to come in. So if you unmute Victoria, take over there.
Yeah, I just thank you, Matthew. I was just going to sort of come in in reference to something you said when you introduced yourself, Matthew, around, you know, AI, and it should be there to serve us. And I think that the big question is, what do we mean by serve us? And if we look at the penal landscape, is it an us or is it a them? And what I'm getting at is around issues to do with power. And I think we need to think carefully about that. What do we mean by serving us? Do we mean to kind of maintain and ameliorate the kind of existing status quo of mass incarceration and the penal landscape? Or do we mean other things? Is it an opportunity to actually reflect, restart? You know, and there's some literature out there. A book that in fact Mike introduced me to many years ago was about the use of smart technologies and the ends of law, and this idea that we need to actually tear up what we've done before and actually restart. Now that's a very idealistic view. So I think we need to address those wider sociological and political questions before we actually talk about the mechanics of the technology. And I think that's what will help us to get to the heart of that ethical discussion. And Stephen and I have written or at least began to propose some ethical principles in relation to the digital prison anyway.
Risk assessment was one of the first areas, wasn't it, that sort of the statisticians and the mathematicians came into criminal justice. You know, we started to do statistical risk predictions in the United States in the 1920s. And we had this whole era that we called the era of actuarial justice in the 1990s and the turn of the century, that a preoccupation with predicting reoffending or predicting serious offending is something that goes back a long way in criminal justice policy, in penal policy. It's been used to inform sentencing. It's been used to inform probation practice. There was a kind of inevitability that if you could improve those things using artificial intelligence, that would be one of the first areas that was looked at. And I agree with everything Matt said about where we're at with it at the moment. But precisely because it has been such a significant area of investment in criminal justice policy, I don't think we're going to stop developing automated understandings of how to do risk assessment. I think that will continue. And there may come a point when the argument that we should just be using this to support and augment human decision making may break down. We may get to a point where someone will say, well, it isn't perfect, this automated risk assessment, but it's good enough. It's good enough because it may well get better from where we are now. It may well get better, right? And that being the case, these questions that Rob and Johan have asked are indeed very pertinent. Part of the answer to Rob's question about we don't want to predict offences, we want to reduce the chances of their taking place. Half the argument about why we should predict is in order to preempt, right? So if we know that the offence is likely to take place, the next step is to then ask ourselves as criminal justice agencies, what can we do to preempt that offence taking place, right? Now, does that mean that we surround the person with police officers? Or does that mean that we provide a lot more rehabilitative and support services and help somebody through a trauma? It can mean all sorts of different things. But the debate about prediction in criminal justice is, at least in part, because I accept that this isn't a universal thing, is it at least in part tied to a debate about preemption? And if we know something is going to happen, if there is a strong probability of something going to happen, what do we have to put in place to preempt it happening? And do we actually know how to do that? And have we got the resources to do it? Now, Johan's point about prediction, I might not answer this as well as he likes, because he is quite right to say that AI is almost always associated with predictions. And that's absolutely right. Prediction is the name of the game. Whether you're running Netflix or Spotify or running Microsoft or running Facebook, predictions are what it's all about. We are moving into an age of massive predictivity, right? Everything that can be predicted using AI will be predicted according to its champions. And this is what Shoshana Zuboff says is the essence of surveillance capitalism. The whole point of this vast scale of data extraction that drives the global economy now, the reason it is done is so that businesses can predict how customers will respond and how they have responded and what they might want next. And it's be used by businesses to predict how their competitors might probably act. And inevitably, governments have got into this technology, because if commercial organizations can predict what customers want, then perhaps governments can predict what citizens want or what criminals can do, right? Predictivity is at the heart of this. Predictivity is the name of the AI game, right? And you see it everywhere you look in criminal justice processes. It's a year since I looked, but at least two electronic monitoring companies have said they're going to move towards predictivity, right? They're no longer emphasizing control and compliance. They want to get into predictivity, because that's what everybody in the Silicon Valley world wants to get into. So yes, there are other uses of AI, but I think before we let go of this issue of predictivity, we should hang around it a bit longer and think through the implications of that.
Okay, Stephen wants to come in.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike, for this very interesting view on it. But I kind of like I'm less pessimistic than you are, I think, on how do you look at AI. First of all, I want to emphasize back to what Pia has said. AI is created. It's just a technology that is created by human beings. So I agree in a lot of things what you're saying, that we have to be careful about what it could become. But I think it doesn't have to be like that and extreme like that. If we just take care and we and we create rules and we assure how we're going to use it. And there is a lot of work on that. I agree, and everyone agrees on this, but I still believe that we have to do it, and it's very important. A second point on that, I think it's also important, and then that's in fact also relating to the question from Rob in the chat and also from Ian, is can AI be used for other things than prediction? I do think it's already used for other things than prediction. So it can be helpful to assist, for example, with observations that a normal human being cannot do, and help supporting that in the prison setting, but I think also in a probation setting. I have seen some very interesting examples of using data to analyze a vulnerability of offenders in prisons, for example, and try to warn. Maybe this is also a prediction, but try to warn about offenders' behavior that could be pointing to suicide risk, for example. There are a lot of possibilities and think helpful. Our Google Maps are in fact also using AI algorithms to bring us from point A to B, and we are trusting it for some reason. So there are also a lot of other things, and I completely agree that I think it's important that we focus on analyzing where could we be helped with, and then build the AI algorithms to support us with that, instead of just focusing on in general how AI algorithms are indeed mainly developed by Googles and by the Facebooks and things like that to drive a decision maker and commercial targets. But that's doesn't have to be like that if we set the boundaries of that, and if we focus and be sure to work and collaborate together that we work on that. And the last point, and then I give it to some of the other colleagues. I think it's very important not to forget that the technology as such, the potential value of technology as such is different from fundamental discussions we have already for decades within criminal justice is about how we do things. For example, what Rob Kenton says is about the difference between the importance of a prediction or trying to reduce predict offenses. It's we want to create an environment and support the offenders to make sure that those things don't happen again. This is very fundamental, but in fact, fundamentally, it has nothing to do with technology. So if we want to build technology, we have to agree first on those things. Technology won't solve it. Can make good things better and can make bad things worse. That's true. But we have to distinct, I think, before some fundamental criminal justice discussions and we have for decades and suddenly say that technology is just like the result of that or something that only makes things worse.
Okay. We've got two or three points and questions come in, which are changing the focus a little bit. We may want to come back to that interesting discussion, but I don't want to miss where our audience wants to take us here. So here's a point from Christelle Bayens from Belgium, and it's wanting to look at an individual offender perspective. Her question is, what does AI have to offer for individual offender supervision? We've tended to look at the macro. So that's one question. And there's another quite similar, if I can just spool down to it without going too far. Is the idea that AI should not only be used on at-risk or individuals? At what point exactly should AI be used? For example, could it be used after 3 months in prisons? So and that from Reto Frischnecht. Now, what I'm thinking is that some people in the audience are thinking, well, okay, can it be used for individuals, not just at the macro sort of meta level? So have people got illustrations or experience of where AI can be used in that way?
John?
Do you want to pick that up, Matt?
Yeah, I don't know if this can help, but it overlaps with the conversation we had previously But the impact on the individual is what's really significant, because when does prediction become a fulfilling prophecy? So if the predictions are this person's going to be high risk for violence, we treat them like they're high risk for violence, and then they become high risk for violence, maybe because of the way we treated them. So this goes back to Victoria's point. You know, these are raising fundamental human questions, like how do we deal with this and prevent, allow the prediction to be useful, but not handcuffs. And an example where we've been toying with using AI type technologies to help the individual is getting at this concept of receptivity. What kind of programming will this individual be responsive to? Taking into account their personality, their language skills, their education, maybe even their hours of availability. You don't want to hook them up with, for example, a drug treatment program that meets when the person will be working. And then they have that stressor of trying to figure out, do I go to work or do I go to the treatment program? So I think that's an example where I think AI is starting to help. It can help a lot in matching the right intervention proportionally to the individual. But again, I going back to the bigger point, I think about us as practitioners, how are we going to manage that prediction versus reality phenomena? Where do we make the prediction come true simply because we're aware of the prediction?
Okay. So in a way, it's a sort of a massive typecasting and forcing people into molds, and that's really dangerous.
Yes.
Okay. Victoria, please pick that up.
A lot of thanks to Mike, our recent conversations, and I listened to the Reef lectures, which I've posted the link in there. I don't know if international listeners can access the BBC. Forgive me if it excludes. And I think Stuart Russell kind of was discussing some really important points, which links to those ideas around bias and data. And I think for me, there were sort of two things that kind of came out of that for me, is that machines and algorithms don't have feelings. They don't know pain. So how can, particularly when we're working with vulnerable groups that have experienced deep pain in many, is that relying on the machine to empathize is perhaps quite dangerous in my mind. But for example, stuff around, and this was in relation to the workplace, if I recall from that conversation, was about creating new levels or new class structures, and how unhelpful that is to society and leading to oppression. I do worry about that, but also around sort of sexism and maintaining a patriarchy, which is very difficult for particularly for women. But this was in the context of the workplace, but I can see how that pans out within the criminal justice system as well. So yes, there is a danger. And so it comes back to that point that I made right at the beginning, the importance to have a sound ethical framework. I've talked about kindness before. That idea remains underdeveloped, but I think what I'm getting at is that can we use technology to be kind to fellow humans? And that's what I would like to see. Thanks.
Yeah, and there's some points being made online about people not being represented in a system that's developing AI and people being excluded from that. Someone called Austin Treacy, thank you for this point, said, could further developments of AI prediction make the human decision more risk averse and reduce opportunities for informed discretion? Does anybody want to pick that up? I see Stephen's got a hand up. Okay, so Mike first, then Stephen, if that's okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I mean, I think that's an interesting question, although I think it can be understood in a couple of different ways, and I might not be answering it in the way that that Austin expects. It does seem to me that if we start using AI-informed decision-making, we might, depending on how trained and experienced we as practitioners are, decide that we ourselves had better trust this machine, because our discretion may leave us vulnerable to the accusation that we didn't use the best available technology to make that parole decision, right? There might come a time when doctors get sued for not using an AI diagnostic program and relying on their own fallible judgment. There might come a time when parole boards get sued for not using an AI to make the judgment, right? If the AI is there, there will be a temptation to rely on it in some degree. And that question of degree is all important, because at the moment, it is easy to say, we'd better not rely on it too much. We'd better allow this to inform human decisions, but we'd better leave the final decision to the human, right? But whether that calculus will remain like that, I think that is an open question, that as more and more people become used to operating within AI-informed systems, our capacity to make wise judgments, to use our discretion well, might start to atrophy. We might lose confidence in ourselves if we have machines. And, you know, to use a quote from way back, T.S. Eliot, a famous British poet, once said, "We should not be in the business of devising systems so perfect that nobody has to be good." And in fact, we haven't done that yet, but we might. But we might.
Let's go, Stephen, and then Pia wants to come in.
Yes. I just was thinking about the fact that we have talked a lot about prediction and risk prediction. I think there is some fundamental problem often in our, again, irrelevant, not related to AI as such, but the fact that we focus on risk. We can also use AI, for example, to focus on strengths. We can use AI to learn about things that work. We can use AI, if we use it clever enough, to give us information about things that we just like would not be able to get based on just reading and data, because it gives us a lot of possibilities to improve our decision making, also for the things that we know there is a lack in current system. There is a lack of human beings for some tasks to be executed thoroughly to help and assist. So again, I see a lot of opportunities if we do it clever and use the data in a clever way, that we can do things better also. That's just the point I want to make. This is not something related again to AI. We know if we compare some systems, for example, in the Nordic countries with some more systems in other countries where they are so focused on risk and risk needs assessments, it's always about risk first. If we can transfer that, we can also can do this and use technology to support that transfer. So it doesn't have to be just only focused on risk.
So I'm doing some work with the probation service, and we're looking at strengths-based interventions. And your point is very powerfully made. Pia, and then I think Victoria wants to come in first. Pia? Pia, I think you're on mute. Have we lost you?
You hear?
Pia, I think we're having trouble with your signal, Pia. You're on mute, but can we try you again? Hello, Pia. I'm really sorry, Pia. We can't actually hear your contribution at the moment. Victoria, perhaps you could just pick that point up. I think it was a strengths-based point. If you could unmute, and then we'll try and get Pia back in as soon as we've got a live signal.
I was just applauding what Stephen said, but I think that what we're looking at is, and I think a lot of the discussion is around the sort of risk base. And I agree with Stephen that we've talked about this before, about the role that technology and perhaps artificial intelligence could play in supporting rehabilitation. I would like to go further and perhaps explore how technology can support desistance, potentially help people build communities to enable kind of recovery from trauma. So that needs to be added, I think, to the discussion, as well as this stuff around predictability, but perhaps using, and we see some good examples, particularly in e-health, and how if people can populate themselves, perhaps applications about themselves, whether or not good things can be pushed towards humans to support them or complement the recovery journey. So I absolutely support Stephen in that idea that if we focus too much on risk, but the task isn't there, particularly of our prisons and probation service, to support people in recovery. And so what can technology do to enable that, as well as the risk side? It's two sides of the same coin, and I don't think we've had enough of that debate either. I don't know what other people think.
We've got a comment on the chat line here, which is a different point about the danger of replacing human beings by machines, particularly if there's a lack of staff. Pia, I'm just wondering whether we can hear you again. Are you able to make a comment, Pia? Looks like we've just got a still photo there, and that the line the connection has been lost. I'm wondering, we will try perhaps get you to rejoin Zoom and make the connection again, which is a real disappointment, because I know you had something to say there. Mike, you would like to come in, and we'll perhaps take a different question shortly. Over to you, Mike.
Okay, thank you. Well, the last set of questions, the last set of issues that got talked about, were really implying, were they not, that advancing rehabilitation is just a technical issue. And the better we are capable of doing it with systems and technologies, the more likely we are to do it. And I wouldn't be in favor of AI being used to support rehabilitation. And I wouldn't be opposed to AI being used to support rehabilitation. And I wouldn't be opposed to having AI do prediction in the cases of serious offenders. And that wouldn't be my critique at all. But when you apply this to rehabilitation, though, for me, the debate becomes a little unreal, because if promoting rehabilitation in a criminal justice system, promoting it in society, was just a question of doing it well, we'd be doing a lot more of it already, irrespective of whether we've got AI. The question of whether we do rehabilitation, the question of whether we support rehabilitation, the question whether we value rehabilitation in our criminal justice system, has never been just a technical question. And it doesn't seem to me to be all that convincing to say that if we were able to do it really well in an informed way using AI, the politicians would be more likely to take it up, right? Even if you could show that was a more cost-effective way of doing it, I don't think in certain political contexts, for example, in England and Wales at the present time, that is likely to make a government keener on rehabilitation just because you can be more effective at doing it. That isn't how promoting rehabilitation in the criminal justice system works. It's never been just a question of technical effectiveness. And adding AI to it, which I agree we could do, and there are automated decision support networks out there which I think in principle would help us to do that. But politically, that's an entirely debatable thing as to whether we go forward with it.
Okay. I see we've got a moving Pia back, which is good. Hi, Pia. We can see you. I wonder if you would like to make the contribution that was stopped by the technology last time. Hi again. Would you like to come in? Oh, no. Looks like we're struggling. Stephen?
Hear me now?
Looks like we're going to have to move over to Stephen again.
Do you hear me now?
Oh, yes, Pierre, I can hear you fine. You go with just sound. That would be great. I think we've lost that. So, Stephen, I'm afraid we're going to have to ask you to fill that void. Over to you, Stephen.
I just want to react a little bit on what Mike was saying. Not saying that I disagree, but I didn't understand his thing that someone here is seeing this and reducing the complex thing of rehabilitation to some technicalities. And I'm afraid that if he thinks that was my point, he misunderstood. So at the contrary, I strongly believe, and I think literature and all the academics around the world know that it's a very, very complicated thing, but that we are a context where we are working in. And we have a lot of things to do. Even further, I believe if we look at AI very simple, that, okay, AI is trained on data and we have to get data off based on how we currently do criminal justice, we'd better not develop any AI systems at all and never use them because we are doing really bad. Eh? I think everyone agrees with the high recidivism everywhere in the world and the mass incarceration. So please don't use AI systems to train on that data, I would say. Yeah. But what I do think is that if we are adopting that technology and focus on the thing that we believe as humans that we can do better, that it could have a very valuable meaning, that technology, to improve the things we are doing. And maybe just one point on something in the chat, it's about AI changing human beings. I think we just have to look at the current situation. We are in lack of a lot of human beings in all areas, also in criminal justice. We are looking for people. So where technology can help, like it has always helped in history, is doing things that we think technology can do things better than human beings, to allow human beings doing things that where they are better in. And I think everyone agrees that we need much more people doing, again, clinical work, working with people in criminal justice and things like that. We are lacking that in criminal justice, in psychiatry, everywhere. People are running the alarm bell on that. So this is what human beings are good thing, and we need people for that. So if we can use technology to reduce the tasks that they are particularly not as good in and help them, I strongly believe that there is a very valuable place for AI also in criminal justice.
Okay. Interesting point on the chat line where a contributor just said that if AI could be used on the developmental potential of offenders, that would be a really good positive. I think we've struggled with Pia, and I think we've lost her temporarily, so I'm sorry about that. What I'd like to do is, for the last half hour of our discussion, is to be more future orientated. So we've had, I think, a big discussion about current issues. Hi, Pia, we see you moving now. And can you try sound, because you've tried several times to come in? Just let's try sound and give you another voice. You're muted at the moment.
Do you hear me now?
Yes.
Please, okay, finally.
Great.
Okay. I don't know what's happening. I'm really sorry for this.
Please don't apologize. Let's go for it. It's great to have you.
Yeah. Just tell me if you lost my voice, because I wanted to say something about the risk analysis and the risk management. And somebody asked about how AI can contribute to individuals. So first of all, about risk analysis, the whole idea is based on the we don't need mathematics, we need psychology. The best predictor of the future behavior is your past behavior. But that is not, of course, what we want to only believe in the criminal sanctions agency. So of course we want to do something to have effect on that that fact that risk means that the best predictor of your future behavior is your past behavior. So for example, in my project, of course we use the risk analysis basics when we analyze the background factors of offenders. But the fact that the RISE AI is also a recommender system means that in this way we will find the best practices for this particular individual to have an effect on the risk. And at the moment we are also analyzing if we could somehow include the so-called strength analysis in this RISE AI system. And I can say it's not easy, but at the moment we are thinking that if there is if AI can detect absence of risk factor, that might refer that there is a strength factor. So at this point we are this far in analyzing both risks and strengths and how to put it into AI form. And this when thinking about the recommendations, that is actually the individual help that that we are also trying to provide, that everybody would find the best practices and solutions for their particular set of risk factors and background factors. Then I wanted to say something about the ethical side. So on the other hand, it's true that since humans program AI systems, there is a risk that we program our own bias into the system. But on the other hand, if we do it correctly, AI can actually correct also the biases that people would have in their thinking, because it's based only on the data and the reasoning. And sometimes emotional factors, for example, affect our decision making also in a wrong way. So ethics should be based on reason, I think, more than on the so-called human factors. So there are both sides to consider what is ethical and what is good to include in the analysis. So there can be bias in both ways. Humans are very biased. And if we program our bias into the system, then the system is biased too. But if we make the system right, it will help us to be more just in our decision makings. So that is what I wanted to say all in the same time, since I'm afraid that the connection will break again.
Well, we gave you a good platform, so that's good. Now, thank you very much, Pia, for the last half hour, and we've not quite half an hour now, but for the last half hour, what we'd like to do is to try to get our audience live on screen to put their questions rather than me do it for them. So try to be a bit more inclusive. If I could say to people sitting out there in Zoom land, what we thought for the last section, we would be forward-looking. And if the questions could be about, well, what next? Where's it going? So I'm going to start with a question about training, because that's about getting practitioners ready. Okay? So that's looking to the future. So my question is, you think things about AI and information and communications technology should be more apparent in the training of probation and prison staff? In other words, should we be getting the new colleagues ready for this new world? So that's my starter question. But what I'm asking the Zoom audience is, do you have questions about where AI is headed? So that's my first question to the panel. Would anyone like to answer that? Okay, Mike first.
Okay, I will take up your training question, but I'll take up your future question first, okay? I think that the most important question we can ask about the future of AI is who has got the power, the economic power, the political power, the cultural power to drive it forward and to set the agenda. Because if we understand that, we'll understand the context in which criminal justice systems, probation services, prison systems will be making their decisions. But there will be a context. We won't be making in criminal justice, in probation, in prisons, we won't be making our decisions in a vacuum, right? This will be, there will be significant developments going on around us in the world of surveillance capitalism, which will impinge on digital governance, digital public services, digital criminal justice, right? And as somebody said in the chat, it's not, AI is not created by human beings. It's created by some human beings, as a matter of fact. It's created for some human beings that are not overrepresented in the global prison system. And the point has been made that it's powerful people who are developing, powerful corporations, powerful companies, powerful nations that are developing this. And at one level, that's outside our remit today. But I want to emphasize it to say that that is the milieu in which criminal justice agencies will be making decisions about how artificial intelligence is going to impinge on them. Now, I've asked around among my network of technological friends as to how they think technology might affect probation. And they came up with this, right? Digital risk assessment, automated risk assessment, automated decision support systems, online rehabilitation programs, which might include virtual reality, and chatbots and voice interaction, which is a kind of a big thing in artificial intelligence and digital at the moment. The point that was been made that was in principle, even with the technologies we have now, you could automate a vast amount of a probation service's work, even with the technologies we have now. Now, the question is, would you want to? Would a government want to do that? Would a government prioritize that? Would a government have the resources to transition from where we are now with probation services to that? And all of those are kind of unknowable questions. But I'm intrigued by my technological friends telling me that all of this would be feasible. We could have easily have an automated probation service. We could easily do that. Now, the thing that's of the ethical things that have been said earlier on in this discussion, it seems to me two points have come up repeatedly, right, which relate to the question of whether we will do things. One is we can set the boundaries. I think that was a phrase that you used, Steve. We can set the boundaries, okay? We can say of this technology, we want it to go this far and no further. We don't want to use it any more than just that, right? Well, that's the one thing.
We need to be quick, Mike.
Yeah, that's the one thing. All right, I'll just make one of these points then. That's the one thing in my experience of working in criminal justice over the last 40 years that I have less confidence in now than I used to have. I don't think we're very good at constraining the political direction in which penal policies go. I just think there are drivers that in the politics of criminal justice which were quite anathema to many of the things that I would consider progressive. And it's not that I don't think AI can do progressive things, but I don't think we have a political culture which is going to want AI to do progressive things. So that's what worries me about the future. And the workforce thing is I don't think we will necessarily feel the need to create the same type of workforce as we have done in the past in prisons or probation, if we have machine augmented systems of running the organizations.
Okay, right. So who would like to pick that up within?
Actually, the one thing that occurred, Matt. Yeah, I don't know if this helps, but the one thing that occurred to me when Mike was making those points that absolutely right now, AI is in the hands of the big corporations and that's concerned. But what we've repeatedly seen is technology can democratize things. For example, this is going to be posted on YouTube. YouTube is a universal communication platform that everybody is exchanging ideas, and it doesn't take a lot of money to get on there. And I think things like AI, if they can simplify computer programming, which I think it's already in the process of doing and will do in the future, is that you may not be dependent on a big corporation anymore to come up with an idea that's related to technology. You'll interact with the technology, telling it what you want, and it will help you program it without this sophisticated background you've needed historically. So I understand Mike's concern 100%. And it goes to Pia's original point of this is just a reflection of us. This technology is a reflection of us. And if it's going to help us, it's because we want to help ourselves. And if it's going to hurt us, it will be our folly, not the technologies.
Okay, thank you. I'm conscious that the chat lines dried up when I asked you to ask questions that you could come onto the Zoom to put. But if you have any questions that you'd like to ask the panel, we've still got 20 minutes, so do come back online. What about training our staff, our future staff, whether it be in prisons or probation or the criminal justice system, to engage with this material, information, communication, technology? Anyone want to pick up that challenge about training?
John, I can tell you what I've been interested in of late, and yeah, I do think that it would be sequential, and I think training would be one of those original fertile areas. But even the idea of a new officer conducting an interview, they may not be aware of their idiosyncrasies and how they communicate. Or if they assume a new case, they may not be familiar with what the client looked like previously or how they interacted previously. And I think in my mind, that's where AI can help. Both increasing officer self-awareness and how they're communicating and how they're coming across, whether they're consistent with policy in terms of the terminology they're using and the demeanor they're reflecting. But at the same time, I think particularly new officers are going to be able to benefit from the institutional knowledge that AI could capture and theoretically transfer in a digestible way to those new officers. To me, it always seems a shame those more senior experienced officers walk out the door and so much knowledge and experience goes with them.
Yeah. Pia, do you want to pick that up? Sorry, Mike.
No.
Pia?
I was about to say about the training of staff. At least in Finland, it's part of our policy to increase the both digital literacy and skills and the AI literacy of both staff and prisoners. It has been part of the Smart Prison project too. And next autumn, we will train our staff to use the new offender management system with this new AI component. And it's going to be a very important part to train staff to use this in a right way. So as Matt said, as a tool to make their work better and smoother and give them some basis for their analysis besides their own expertise, but also turn the expertise that we already have in the form of the RISE AI. And in Finland, we also have a so-called national AI program at the moment. So our government has a project called Aurora AI. And we are all the agencies, the governmental agencies are going to be part of an AI network. So we are combining all our services into a common network where people can find suitable services and get suitable service recommendations from the AI network of different service providers. And I think this in this project, in this Aurora AI project, it has been an important part that it's very human-centered. The ethical side is a lot considered. And at the same time, we are using heightened latest technique to create the system. So the system is as good as the people who develop it, who program it. So we need to have the best expertise, and they have to know the ethical requirements that we need for these systems to work. And there's a lot of ways I think AI can benefit. I think why people have this fear is actually the lack of basic AI literacy. So lack of knowledge usually produces fear and these kind of terror images, what's going to happen. So we need to educate people and staff and prisoners, and we will avoid this worst case scenario. So I'm positive about the future, at least in Finland, and Scandinavian countries are a lot ahead of the development in digitalization of prison systems, Finland and Norway in particular.
Okay, we have got a request from Austin Treacy. Could the panel comment on other AI applications in the custody sector, making them safer for vulnerable prisoners? And do they see in time AI changing the role of the prison officer? So that's very specific, again, looking ahead, also looking at service users there. Anybody want to pick that up? Thank you, Stephen.
Yes. I can give quickly, because I'm aware of time, some examples. I've already, I thought, mentioned a vulnerability predictive tool that uses, in fact, data of behavior, very basic behavior, the number of telephone calls people have, the number of visits have, and things like that, to try to predict when people are getting more isolated or having behavior that could point to some, for example, suicidal risk and things like that. So there are some very good examples out there. I think there are also more and more AI, especially used in pattern recognition and voice analytics and things like that. So natural language processing is used in a lot of pilots, both in community corrections or probation as in the context of prisons. And again, it's all about how you shape it and what is the aim for, what are you aiming for? So if I can just quickly say something about the future, reflecting on what Mike was saying, I agree that it's difficult to change politicians. But what I'm sure of, if all the experts and the academical people do nothing, to work together to try to use technology, analyze it, and look where it can be made for the good, we will never be able to influence them. So I've seen from my experience in my career in Belgium and now as a consultant that it's possible to influence those policymakers and to try to set those boundaries and try to publish, promote the good use of technology. Technology has the capacity of making things worse, but also making good things better. So it's both things, and it's the humans that have to decide how to drive this. And I think it's similar for AI. And just one small point on the educational aspect, it's extremely important to involve the human beings who are using that technology, and because the change can be huge. And also at that point, we can see that sometimes we exaggerate or overthink the capabilities that people have to adapt to technology. So again, it's very important to focus on technology and training staff and people who use the technology. It's very, very important to do that. So that's what's my final point of education.
Okay, now I'm going to go around the panel. Because we're not that far from the end time. What I'd like to ask you to do is to see if you've got any advice to people in the field or any final points that you'd like to make to our listeners as we head towards wrap up. Matt, I'm wondering if you'd like to kick off, and I'll go around everybody in turn. Is there any closing points you'd like to make to the audience? So Matt, what would you like to say?
I think basically that AI is an extremely powerful tool. And if good people with good intentions don't use it, or they deny themselves the tool, bad people with bad intentions will use it. So it's a tool. It's only a means to an end. It's not an end unto itself. But I think, again, I applaud you for having this kind of discussion. And I think there has to be a lot more discussions, as everybody's saying, and developing principles and priorities. But again, I think the genie's out of the bottle. AI is coming. And I think Pia mentioned AI literacy. That is critical at this point about what it's capable of and what it's not. But it goes back to Victoria's point. These are all human decisions that we have to resolve. And only we can do that at this stage. I was almost thinking humorously when Pia couldn't get on, in the future, if AI doesn't want to hear Pia's opinion, will it literally knock her out? But right now, fortunately, I don't think it's there. So I think these conversations are really important. So I appreciate you having it.
Right. In the interest of making sure we can get Pia while she's there live and blinking on our screens, Pia, the floor is yours. What advice would you want to give to practitioners, or what are your final comments?
Yeah, I liked what Stephen said, that we have to believe that we can have influence on things. So practitioners, researchers, experts, we shouldn't stay passive in this process. So we have to get interested in this. Sometimes people in humanities have this kind of, they are a little bit aversive towards technology. And this is a very bad thing, because if we want the so-called good AI, we must combine humanities, the knowledge we have in humanities, to technology. And that's what I've been interested a lot since my basic education is a psychologist, but at the moment I'm working with digital projects. And I think that has been my strength, that I come from a totally different background than most of the team that I'm working with. And I think it's very important that I'm, as a psychologist, part of the team. So I believe we can have influence, and we should be brave in experimenting and testing. And yes, also involving, as we will do with RISE AI, that we will also involve offenders in the process. So we will try to share the results, the proof of concept and the test use results, with real offenders, to see if the recommendations match with their idea of what the recommendations for them should be. So we can develop it together. I'm sure about that. And I also want to say that what I said about the fears of technology, so it's both the lack of knowledge, but also people usually fear things that they think they cannot control. And since technology is developing so fast, I think it's a very understandable reaction that we feel that we are not anymore in control what AI, for example, can become. So that's why it's really important that we have AI literacy. That's why it's really important that we participate in the process, that we believe that we can have influence, that we don't stay passive. And we involve in the development of technology, we involve people with different backgrounds, like backgrounds from more social and psychological background, like myself.
Thank you. That was beautifully put. Thank you very much indeed. And the sound was fantastic the whole way through, Pia, so that was really good. Thank you. Mike, would you like to have the floor next?
Okay. Well, in terms of thinking about the future, I would like, because I accept that this technology is coming in some shape or form, I accept that it is coming. So I think that the unions and the professional associations, in particular, in the criminal justice systems that I'm familiar with, who may not have realized that this technology is not too far away from them, I think it is very important that they get on top of the debates about AI and work out, if they can, what they think will be beneficial and what they think will be threatening, and debate that. So I think that the professional criminal justice debate about artificial intelligence can be a bit myopic sometimes, and unwilling to see or even imagine that there is a bigger context to what's going on in their professional world outside of them. And I think when you interrogate the people who are looking at the bigger picture about AI, they are worried about a cybersecurity nightmare, because my answer to Matt's point is both the good guys and the bad guys will use AI. It's not a question of the good guys using it so the bad guys don't. Both sets of guys are going to use AI. And I think that's going to create a milieu in which we have a cybersecurity nightmare. We already have the rudiments of a cybersecurity nightmare now. People may not have realized that, but it's only going to be exacerbated by artificial intelligence. So there's a big picture which the immediate professionals who are concerned about this in criminal justice need to get to grips with. And I think that this concept of AI literacy is indeed a very useful one, but there's more than one narrative about artificial intelligence, and I think it's important to try and understand all of them. The irony of me being alarmed about this technology is because 20 years ago, when I got interested and excited about the prospects of electronic monitoring, the boot was on the other foot. I was the one who has been told that I was over enthusiastic about this technology. But in some ways, I've learned. I don't think we have used electronic monitoring in criminal justice in the UK in the United States as well as we could have done. In fact, I'm quite alarmed about some of the things that we've done with it. I'm always less alarmed about what goes on in Scandinavia. The Scandinavians, the Finns, the Norwegians, the Swedes, you're good guys and you tend to use all these technologies well, but I don't think you're typical. And that's why I worry about it more than you do, Pierre.
Right, Mike, warning flags there, but thanks very much indeed. Good wisdom. Stephen, over to you.
Yeah, thank you, John. I think we're all in line on the need to think about it, to analyze more deeply, and to be very, very careful with how technology can be used. There are some different opinions here about how and the impact and what will happen in the future. I'm mainly my thing is that what based on my experience working in the field of technology and started my career as a probation officer. What I have seen is that problematic was the lack of engagement, the lack of involvement in technology-related projects from the business, from academics, from politicians. It was like technology is something like for the nerds in the corner over there. And because of that, technology has been shaped in many, many, many projects by private companies who just make money out of it. What I've seen in all the projects, the digital transformation project I've worked in, where it makes a difference is when people start to care. They involve, they engage. And this is what we have to do in criminal justice. I don't know that we will win it towards the bad guys, that the good guys will win it towards the bad guys, things like that. I even don't want to go in that direction of polarizing things. But what I do, the only thing that we can make sure that if we use AI, that it's going to be used for the good, is that we all engage and we all be critical. And also, and then I especially agree also what Victoria and Pia has been saying, that we are believing and trusting us as human beings and that we can change it and that we can say that the humans are creating this technology. So that's my message. It's engaging, and I'm not meaning that we have to use AI, but engaging meanings, but we have to have this conversation and analyze where it can be good for used for the good.
Thank you, Stephen. And Victoria?
Yeah, thank you, Stephen. I absolutely agree with that. And I also recognize Mike's position. And I think the debate isn't as polarized as we think it is. And for me, I think I've seen some very powerful shifts in decision making with respect to kind of co-production, engaging all stakeholders, including the public, including families of those involved in the criminal justice system. You know, what are the needs, and can we design solutions that might not involve technology or artificial intelligence to actually meet the needs of humans. And this is what we're talking about here. And so, you know, the power of co-producing solutions may negate this kind of tidal wave or the fear of the tidal wave that machines will take over the world, and that they will be thinking for us and making the decisions on behalf of us. I think that we have a sort of moral obligation to ensure that all solutions are meeting human needs, and that these are framed in I suppose for the public good, a shift towards not just exacerbating the punitive landscape and feeding these corporate machines. It's about meeting the needs, right? And we want our criminal justice system to work. And I agree with Mike's point earlier about, you know, that there's this kind of myth we need to demystify some kind of narratives around technology that it will make things better. There can be unintended consequences that we've seen elsewhere in society where technologies come. So I'm very kind of pro meeting needs and the kind of decisions around developing, you know, new policies, new practice should come from kind of collaboration. That's really where I want to finish. Thank you.
Well, that sounds like a good place to conclude, and it's almost time to sign off. I've got a friend who said he saw some research from America, Matt, of all places, where they got AI to assess some legal documents. And they got the AI system to assess these legal documents in 22 seconds, better than it would take a lawyer maybe an hour to do. So I think what I'm saying is that from a different part of the justice system, AI is coming and it's going to shake us all up one way or another. And if it's shaking up American lawyers, you can bet it's going to shake us up too. Well, I think the time's come to draw the discussion to a close. And I want to give you the news that INCJ has an action research hub looking at information and communications technology and its influence on practice after the pandemic. So I want you to keep an eye open for details of a webinar on this topic, which is going to take place in late April 2022. So if you're interested to hook into this for further discussion, well, follow us on Twitter, which, as I've said earlier, is at INTCJ Network, or visit the website, which is www.criminaljusticenetwork.net. So, with a really big thank you to our panel members and to you for watching and listening, can I say goodbye? Stay safe, keep well, goodbye, and see you next time. You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.